What's up, guys? And today we are going to be looking at how the characters of the Nightmare Before Christmas, how those characters died. And, well, how it's theorized how they died, at least. So, let's get to the music. Right, as always, well, maybe not as always, but this article is from lifeandstylemag.com. And the article is titled, "These Nightmare Before Christmas's Character Death Theories Will Keep You Wide Awake." Let's start. Once kids get tired of the sappier Christmas movies, they move on to Tim Burton's 1993 stop-motion fantasy, The Nightmare Before Christmas. As dark as that film is, though, we never find out how the ghoulish residents of Halloween Town died, or even if they are, in fact, dead. Reddit user, I am potato F-KU. However, got the that conversation going in the fan theories forum. For example, this Redditor thinks Sally's line, "I had a vision," hints at her death. Sally may have been suspected of witchcraft when she was living, due to her being able to see the future. And she was dismembered as a punishment for being a witch, they wrote. Not to mention, she does know her way around herbs, nightshade, witch hazel, etc. Now, apparently back in the days of Salem witch trial, that is one of the ways they did execute their victims. By dismembering them. And there were a lot of witches tried, not only in Salem, but in other places as well. And I think Salem wasn't even the first place to hop on the witch hunt craze. Like, that's not where it started. It started somewhere else, I think. A commenter on the post, a Redditor named The Knight in the TARDIS? Yeah, linked to a Tumblr post explaining the death of some other characters in the film, including Jack Skellington, Dr. Finkelstein, I almost said Frankenstein, but it's Finkelstein, the mayor of Halloween Town, and Oogie Boogie. None of those characters appear to have died peacefully. Funny story. I was thinking I was recording the next segment of this episode that you're listening to right now. Turns out I had exited out of the voice recorder, so it didn't record anything I had said, and I didn't realize till after I read the rest of the article. So yeah. But anyways, let's get on with it. Jack was burned alive. This Tumblr author posited, since Jack is just a skeleton in the movie, and since we see him go up in flames at the beginning, and apparently from what I've heard, nothing sticks onto the bone if you burn a body. Yeah. Dr. Finkelstein was poisoned, which is why none of Sally's poisoning attempts have seemed to have much an effect on him. In fact, if I remember clearly, it just makes him fall asleep. Just knocks him out for a little bit. The mayor, meanwhile, probably died of a broken neck since his... Excuse me. Since his head seems to do a 180 turn at the slightest provocation. Provocation. Yeah. But I also heard a theory of how he broke his neck. It was because he was bipolar. And basically hung himself. Yeah. Locke froze to death, which explains his pale skin and blue lips. Oogie Boogie was skinned alive, which is why he's just a burlap sack with insects for innards. Yuck. And Zero, the dog, was electrocuted. The fact that he looks like smoke and his jack-o'-lantern nose illuminates like a light bulb clued us in. So these are some Nightmare Before Christmas... are some Nightmares Before Christmas, right? Of course. It's entirely possible these beloved characters aren't dead humans at all, but an entirely different species of life. But either way, let the record show that Tumblr user does cite "You ruined my childhood," as one of the most frequent responses to his post. Don't you just love when people ruin your childhood? Next is a article called "The Untold Truth of the Nightmare Before Christmas" from Looper.com. When Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas premiered in October 1993, so like 2 months before Christmas was actually supposed to, just 2 months before Christmas, before the Christmas season. So it's a Halloween movie, more so. It did so with surprisingly little fanfare for a film developed by Disney. You wouldn't expect that Disney produced a movie like Nightmare Before Christmas, seeing as some of the ways that the characters may or may not have died makes the movie a little bit dark. Heck, it's dark as is, but people love it, so. Why is it that I always have a runny nose now when I record these episodes? Dang. While it was lauded by the top critics of the day, it wasn't the immediate success that Burton director Henry Selick and their dedicated team of animators had hoped for. After the film left theaters, however, it began a transition from beloved cult movie to cultural phenomenon. Before long, Jack Skellington's grinning skull was everywhere from t-shirts to tattoos. And the story of how this creepy classic came about is just as interesting as the film itself. The idea originated from a Burton poem. Burton originally penned the story of The Nightmare Before Christmas as a poem when he was a young man working as an animator for Disney, a role he never quite settled into, going as far as likening his time there to being stuck in a prison. Despite his education at the prestigious California Institute of the Arts, Burton could never adapt his own style to that preferred by Disney. Something that became clear to him while working on 1981 feature The Fox and the Hound. "I couldn't draw those four-legged Disney foxes. I just couldn't do it." He later recalled, "I couldn't even fake the Disney style. Mine looked like roadkills." After a brief run as a concept artist, Burton was ultimately deemed expendable, though he kept in touch with another animator struggling to adhere to the Disney way, Henry Selick. Burton shared his haunting poem about a skeletal figure named Jack Skellington with Selick, who showed immediate interest in directing a feature version. Beetlejuice co-writer Michael McDowell was enlisted to adapt the poem for the screen, and production started in 1991. Disney developed the film, but distanced themselves from it, because Disney does not want to be associated with anything dark. Kind of And this is kind of what they're trying, what they tried to do with the Black Cauldron. Disney, I know you're trying to hide that. Black Cauldron, from what I hear, is like basically animated horror. So, like, why did Disney create it in the first place if they now regret it and are trying to hide it? I mean, that's what I've heard, is that they're really trying to make people forget that this movie exists. But they're not doing that with The Nightmare Before Christmas. And I think they sort of can't at this point. Having initially considered turning Burton's holiday-themed poem into an 80s TV special or a short film similar to 1982's Vincent, also based on a Burton poem, only to back out, Disney relented as the decade came to a close. The success of 1988's Beetlejuice and 1990's Edward Scissorhands gave Burton enough negotiating power to arrange the developmental deal with Disney, and the project was finally greenlit. With Burton acting as a go-between for the studio and his chosen director, after seeing the first trailer, however, then Chairman CEO Michael Eisner decided that The Nightmare Before Christmas was just too dark for typical Disney audiences. The trailers were edited and the film was shifted to Touchstone Pictures, the distribution imprint Disney used for movies with the kind of adult-themed content they don't want to associate with their children-friendly brand. Yet, from what I can remember of seeing YouTube videos, there's like a whole ton of adult jokes in some Disney movies just like hidden. And they took their stories, the Disney princess stories, from really dark original stories anyways. Sure, they made those films kid-friendly, but if you actually look at the original stories which Disney based them off of, super-duper dark. So, I don't know why... I guess I know why they would be not wanting to at first show The Nightmare Before Christmas ever, but, like, too dark? Are you sure about that, Disney? They still hid a Mickey in it, as Disney does with all of their, or maybe not all of their films, but with a good amount of them. And there's a picture. You can see Mickey and Donald Duck and on the little boy's pajamas, there's Donald Duck, and on the little girl's pajamas, she's wearing a dress with Mickey on it. So, yeah, Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse both got a cameo in this movie. That's kind of weird to say. Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck got a cameo in Nightmare Before Christmas. Despite Disney not wanting to associate themselves with it publicly, tribute was still paid to the Mouse House in The Nightmare Before Christmas in the form of a hidden Mickey. And hidden Donald Duck. Let's not give Mickey all the fame here. I mean, he does, but, like, he does have all the fame, but, like, Donald Duck needs some recognition, too. This decades-old tradition of subtly including Mickey Mouse in some shape or form in every Disney animated feature has never been acknowledged by the company, though that doesn't stop fans going over their films with a fine-toothed comb in search of this guaranteed Easter egg. Spoiler alert, you can see Mickey, Goofy, and I believe Donald Duck as well in the crowd in the movie The Little Mermaid when King Triton enters to watch his daughters sing while Ariel is exploring the ship. It's like as he's passing over the crowd, you just, if you look hard enough amongst all the merfolk, you'll see a dog, a mouse, and a duck. Sure, ducks swim on water, but, like, what the heck are... So Mickey and Goofy can breathe underwater now? What the heck? Okay, I'm going off on a tangent. Let's focus. While some films only get Mickey, however, others get more than one Disney legend making a sneaky appearance. Like Nightmare, for instance, as the children of the world wake up on Christmas morning and find their presence to be a lot more terrifying than usual, a set of siblings can be seen sporting some unmistakably Disney pajamas. One set featuring Mickey, the other patterned with the face of Donald Duck. I did not notice these at first, so... good job, Disney, on hiding them. Fire, smoke detector. It took more than 3 years to complete. Dang. I mean, I guess since it's like stop motion and... from what I can think of, stop motion does take a long time because you have to move the character a little bit, take a picture. Move the character a little bit, take a picture. It's a long process. I've never tried... well, I technically have tried it. But not well. Stop motion animation may not look quite as smooth and silky as modern CGI, but the effort that went into making The Nightmare Before Christmas rivals anything Disney has done with Pixar in the years since. The film was shot at 24 frames per second. That's a lot of frames in a minute or an hour. Which meant that the characters had to be painstakingly repositioned 24 times for every second of the film. It took a whole week to create just a single minute of footage. No wonder it took 3 years. You get 1 minute of film in a week. It's gonna take a long time, guaranteed. To create the entire film. With the entire process stretching out for more than 3 years. It wasn't just a case of nudging and a figurine slightly to the right either. The characters themselves had to be carefully disassembled and reassembled for every frame so their facial expressions matched what was happening on screen. With particular focus on getting Jack and Sally right, the Pumpkin King had more than 400 interchangeable heads, whereas his ragdoll love was redesigned with a series of masks that covered all the necessary emotions. Oogie Boogie was the toughest character to design. Despite being a simple burlap sack filled with creepy crawlies, nightmares, and antagonist, Oogie Boogie was actually the hardest character to create. Director Henry Selick admitted in an interview that visual consultant Rick Heinrichs had to intervene to re-sculpt the bulky boogeyman, with his demise in the film proving particularly tricky to navigate. The scene in which Oogie is fatally unraveled, spilling his insect insides everywhere, consisted of 4 shots that took a full month to make. The animators were not the only people to complain about Oogie Boogie, with many viewers feeling that Ken Page's portrayal of the villain verged on racist. Selick defended the character, insisting that Page modeled his voice performance on Cab Calloway in the old Betty Boop cartoons. This argument is supported by the fact that 2 lines of dialogue are lifted directly from 1933 Betty Boop cartoon The Old Man of the Mountain, and composer Danny Elfman has a long history of channeling Calloway, as he did in the film Forbidden Zone. They started filming it without a completed script. I don't think I've heard of that being done before. They probably had to have at least half of the script when they decided to start filming, at least. Or else you have nothing to, go off of. The time-consuming nature of making a stop-motion feature meant that Selick and his team were keen to get started on making The Nightmare Before Christmas as soon as they humanly could, even if it meant doing so without a completed script. Production on the film began in San Francisco in 1991, when Selick had nothing but Burton's best wishes and a few songs to go on. We had 3 songs by Danny Elfman, but no real screenplay, and we had to start because we had a pretty tight budget, and had to finish the movie in time, he admitted. So we started off with the song, What's This? There's something deep in In the end, Elfman's girlfriend at the time, Carolyn Thompson, was brought in to help move the script along after Michael McDowell fell ill and was unable to complete it. Selick credits Thompson with stitching the songs together and making the film work as a complete piece. Burton and Elfman fell out over Jack's voice. They had a big fight about it, in other words. All of Jack Skellington's musical numbers in the final cut of The Nightmare Before Christmas were sung by Danny Elfman himself. That's Nightmare Trivia 101. What not everybody knows, about what everybody does not know, is that the former Oingo Boingo frontman also recorded all of the Pumpkin King's speaking parts. While he nailed the singing as expected, Elfman's voice acting wasn't up to Selick's standards. And in the end, he had to go to Burton with the issue. when the pair decided that they would have Chris Sarandon come in to re-record the scenes, Elfman took it badly, refusing to score Burton's next film, Ed Wood. Despite having to share the credit for Jack Skellington, Elfman's contribution to Nightmare should never be understated. The world-renowned composer also gave his voice to Beryl, the smallest of Oogie Boogie's miniature henchmen, as well as the clown with the tearaway face. In the end, his voice being in the movie just wasn't enough for Elfman, who had the animators create a shrunken version of his head and hide it inside a cello. Burton was supposed to have his own cameo. Speaking of severed heads, Tim Burton was also supposed to appear in the film during a brief shot in which three skating vampires play ice hockey on a frozen lake. But their makeshift puck was changed to a jack-o'-lantern at the last moment. The assumption is that Disney deemed the inclusion of their former employee's head a step too far and leaned on Selleck to change it. Though the original storyboard has since been released alongside a number of deleted scenes, the footage narrated by Selleck himself also revealed that a number of other parts of the film were altered for the final cut, including Jack's attempts to discover the meaning of Christmas through a series of scientific experiments, which had a number of visual gags removed, and Oogie Boogie's dance, which was supposed to include a small scene created using cell animation, but was eventually cut to help rein in the running time. Oogie Boogie was Dr. Finkelstein in disguise in early versions. The biggest reveal from the unearthed early footage was a twist ending that was eventually removed for a more straightforward but no less engrossing climax. The storyboard in question details an alternate take on the moment that Jack rescues Sally from the burlap clutches of Oogie Boogie. When the boogeyman's sack starts to unravel, it isn't just worms and spiders that come spilling out. Dr. Finkelstein is in there too. His reason for kidnapping Sally is pure jealousy. Taking her because even though it was he who created her from bits of flesh and scraps of cloth, she still chose Jack. A defiant Finkelstein goes on to call Jack an oblivious twit and explain that he wanted to teach Sally a lesson before declaring his intentions to make a new creation and disappearing through a trapdoor. Vincent Price was supposed to voice Santa. Burton became a fan of Vincent Price at a young age, following his career closely and eventually managing to convince his idol to work with him on 1982's Vincent. This semi-autobiographical short delves into the somewhat disturbed mind of a seemingly normal suburban boy whose deepest desire is to be just like Vincent Price. Price narrated the 5-minute film, and the pair worked together once more in 1990's Edward Scissorhands, in which the horror icon made his last screen appearance as the titular character's inventor. though their third collaboration had to be called off after Price's wife passed away. Selleck revealed that Price came into the studio to record his parts, which included the opening and closing monologues of the film. Though the veteran actor was despondent after losing his wife and they were forced to consider alternatives, Burton and Selleck met with Don Ameche, who was subsequently deemed too grouchy for Santa, and James Earl Jones had discussions with Elfman that ended in an angry shouting match. In the end, Ed Ivory, a relative unknown to prior experience, was entrusted with the part. The voice of Patrick Stewart was also cut. Easily the biggest actor to find his voice work cut from the film, Patrick Stewart was brought in onto Nightmare early on in its development, when Burton's original poem was supposed to play a bigger part in the narrative. The intention was to have Burton's words read at length over the course of the movie, and Stewart's unmistakable tones were considered perfect for the job. The Star Trek legend recorded a film-length adaptation of the poem, as well as a rendition of Burton's original piece in its entirety. Though, as the story developed and the movie was reshaped, Stewart's parts were reduced to just the opening and closing monologues. In the end, it was decided that those verses would be recited by the film's Santa, Ed Ivory, and the Stewart version ended up on the cutting room floor, and the film's official soundtrack. Christopher Lee also recorded the poem. Another of Burton's horror heroes came in to do a reading of his original The Nightmare Before Christmas poem, Christopher Lee, whose definitive recording appeared as an extra on the Collector's Edition DVD. The pair quickly became friends, working together on a number of live-action and animated projects, before Lee passed away in 2015 at the age of 93. Burton led the tributes, revealing just how influential Lee was on him and his career. Christopher has been an enormous inspiration to me my entire life. I had the honor and pleasure to work with him on 5 films, said Burton. He was the last of his kind, a true legend who I am fortunate to have called a friend. He will continue to inspire me, and I'm sure countless others for generations to come. Jack went on to have skeleton children. In the final cut of the film, the last that Jack and old Sandy Claus, see of each other is when the latter, after saving Christmas and forgiving his counterpart for attempting to commandeer the holiday, flies over Halloween Town and gives the residents their first ever snowfall. In an unused epilogue scene, however, Santa reveals that he actually visited his old friend Jack years after their holidays disastrously crossed paths and found him with a handful of musically inclined children by his side. And though that one Christmas things got out of hand, I'm still rather fond of that Jack Skeleton Man, recalled Santa. So many years later, I thought I'd drop in. And there was old Jack, still looking quite thin, with 4 or 5 skeleton children at hand, playing strange little tunes in their xylophone band. Burton quashed the idea of a sequel. So there's no sequel happening. Rumors about a sequel to The Nightmare Before Christmas was being developed are nothing new. Gathering pace every time a former cast member or colleague mentions the idea of a second film, only to inevitably come to nothing. One piece of gossip that turned out to be true, however, is that Disney considered making a second Nightmare film in the late 90s. And early 2000s. Though they insisted that it be rendered with CGI this time around. While Selleck has always emphasized that a sequel would have to be stop motion, Burton has been far less receptive. To the idea of making a return to Halloween Town, stop motion or otherwise. I was always very protective of it, not to do sequels or things of that kind. You know, Jack visits Thanksgiving World or other kings of things, he explained. Just because I felt that the movie had a purity to it, it was important to keep that kind of purity of it. Selleck used Jack Skellington in later films. The fact that Burton had no intention of creating the Nightmare Before Christmas sequel did not stop Selleck from returning to the character later. He gave him a cameo in 1996's James and the Giant Peach, and brought him out again for the 2009 stop-motion adaptation of Neil Gaiman's novel Coraline, a Burton-esque story following the plight of a titular child as she discovers a doorway to a sinister parallel world hidden in her new home. The film evoked nightmare in a number of ways, though those with a keen eye were able to spot a far more direct reference, as Coraline's mother cracks eggs over a bowl. Jack's grinning skull can be seen inside one of the dripping yolks. A blink and you'll miss it nod to the Pumpkin King. There's already sort of a sequel and a prequel. In the mid-2000s, Capcom released a video game called Oogie's Revenge, which takes place after the events of the Nightmare Before Christmas film. Jack gets bored with his life again, while Oogie is sewn back together by his trio of henchmen, and the burlap sack decides he wants to be the king of all holidays, not just Halloween. The game ends pretty much identically to the film, with Oogie again defeated, and Jack once again rededicated to his true calling of Halloween. No one said it was a great story. And there's a video game prequel too, The Pumpkin King. Released at the same time as Oogie's Revenge, actually explains the huge gaps in the film's continuity. The conflict and jealousy between Jack and Oogie is explored, as well as why exactly Oogie has to live underground in his lair. Spoiler alert, it's because, once again, he lost a fight with Jack. All right, so those were two articles on the movie The Nightmare Before Christmas, both the untold truth of the movie and the possible theories of character deaths. Now, I know there is more theories on character deaths for this movie, because I have seen quite a few, and I think one of them is clearly seen in one of the characters. He has an axe in his head. The theory that I heard is that he was a worker during the Industrial Revolution, maybe building some type of structure like a skyscraper. And from a picture that I've seen, they did not have any type of equipment to, like, protect them, like hard hats, any of that stuff that we have nowadays. They did not have that. So, I don't know what happened, like an axe fell, or somebody threw an axe or something. I don't know why people would be throwing axes, but people do that sometimes, I guess. But the axe landed in this poor character's head and killed him, which causes some brain damage for this character in the afterlife. So, yeah. Anyways, that's it for now, for today. And I hope you guys have a great day, a great life, a great whatever. Stay safe out there, and I'll see you next time. Bye!